So welcome everybody to this evening's discussion on organising within and around Muslim communities in the UK, challenges and opportunities. And I'm delighted that we have such a prestigious panel this evening. Our speakers include Sir Iqbal Sakrani from the Muslim Council of Great Britain, Khalida Khan, Executive Director and co-founder of Anisa Society, Sarah Sharif, founding member of the Muslim Women's Helpline, and Fadi Itani from the International Relations Unit of Islamic Relief. Each speaker will speak for about 10 minutes, and they will speak in turn, and then we will open it up to the floor for questions. We anticipate finishing about 10 to 8, and then you're all welcome to join us for tea, coffee, and snacks on the fifth floor in the chairman's dining room. Okay. We'll start, Sir Iqbal Sakrani will start the discussion. And we'll speak for about 10 minutes. And then I'll hand over to Khalida Khan, Sarah Sharif, and Fadi Itani. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Kind, Most Merciful. Chair, fellow speakers, distinguished guests, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and good evening to you as well. May I first of all thank the LSE and the Department for Social Policy for giving us the opportunity to interact and discuss on an important subject of organizing within and around the Muslim communities in the UK. The title is a bit lengthy and covers areas perhaps much more than one would have anticipated, but at least we'll have a go and say and talk about and perhaps hear a bit more in terms of what the community is all about. In an environment in which our differences are constantly emphasized, it is striking how much common ground we occupy, sometimes even without realizing it. This is true in the case of our vision of an inclusive Britain. It is also true in terms of our commitment to civil society and the community in which we live in. In both cases, the values we hold as Muslims are shared by our fellow citizens, Britons, whatever their faith or ethnic background. This evening, I would like to outline what this shared vision means, how we can realize it in practice, and what new opportunities we can exploit along the way as communities in the UK. The vision of Britain we in the Muslim Council of Britain espouse is of a diverse and an inclusive society, one which is multi-faith as well as no faith, and multicultural, one where no groups are left behind through disadvantage or discrimination, one which is vibrant and successful. This vision is not dissimilar to the one the government recently set out in its race strategy, which we have certainly welcomed. These aspirations of inclusivity are shared by Muslims across the country. We see ourselves very much as British Muslims, part and parcel of a diverse border in Britain. And therefore, the communities we come from and the community organizations that we are part of indeed espouse the same ethos. So why are inclusivity, diversity, and civil society important to the communities? And what does it all mean in practice? An easily overlooked feature of Britain's 1.6, 1.8 million Muslims is its own diversity. The community is drawn from many ethnic backgrounds and cultures, a microcosm of British society. Muslims are a multicultural community united through strong ties of faith identity that transcend ethnic boundaries. In fact, it is a community of communities. This gives the Muslim community a uniquely cosmopolitan outlook. Muslims also have strong traditions in building and maintaining civil society institutions. the Muslim community has invested heavily in building up its own voluntary and community organizations over a relatively short period of time. Not just mosques or community centers, but campaigning organizations, schools, and projects to help gain life skills, relief organizations, you name it. They are there at the moment in the community. They are dotted around the country, and the common feature is their dependence on volunteers. Indeed, the Muslim Council of Britain is one of these organizations, established nearly 8 years ago after a period of extensive consultation with the Muslim community. Our remit is to serve and represent the community we belong to nationally. We make no such claims that we are the only body representing the entire Muslim community. That's not possible, and that's not practical either. But today we are the largest organization of its kind, with 400 organizations affiliated to us. These organizations are of diverse nature. Again, which I referred earlier on, community organizations, mosques, institutions, relief organizations, welfare associations, specialist women bodies, student societies, all the normal community organizations that do exist in the country. We are democratically constituted, and this is an important feature in the Muslim community. Most of office bearers, including myself, are elected on a fixed term. And although our main concern is the welfare of British Muslims, we believe this must be sought by serving and sharing in the common good of our society as a whole. In practical terms, this means participating in wider society, playing an active part as responsible and concerned citizens. We view this not just as a religious duty, but indeed a social duty as well. So this vision, which I hope is shared, and Muslims are making a positive contribution to the society in which we live in, which we are part of, but a number of obstacles still prevent us from realizing our vision. The problems, the constraints that face the Muslim community and community organizations. In the interest of brevity, I would like to highlight one conceptual obstacle and two practical obstacles. There are a number of others, but these three are of particular importance to us here today. Let us start with the conceptual challenge. Simply put, this revolves around mutual understanding. In part, this finds expression around the debate about the meaning of multiculturalism in modern Britain. As the academic Tariq Maudood notes, this is partly because Muslims are calling the accommodation of their religious needs in the public sphere. This is an arena that has hitherto been largely secular. At the same time, some commentators are questioning whether Muslims are truly part of British society beyond issues of security and terrorism. Only last weekend we had this poll, no other paper than the Sunday Telegraph, each time questioning us, the Muslim community, where does your loyalty lie? Is it the country you come from, the country where you adopted, or the country you are born in? And it is sadly the community, the Muslim community, this time and again questioned this very point. However, the overwhelming people who responded to the poll clearly said that their loyalty lies with Britain, the country in which they live in, the country they were born in. Yet, that answer was not projected to the community at large. What was projected was this minority view that came in, and when they were questioned in terms of Sharia, a loaded question of what is, whether you would like to see Sharia introduced in the UK. It's more saddening when people like Trevor Phillips, chair of the CRA, a body that purports to represent the ethnic minorities and supposedly supposed to enhance their rights and their concerns in a very positive way, seems to be using this opportunity to attack and demean the Muslim community. If only one would understood what Sharia stands for. The great difficulty we have is understanding the concept of Sharia as though it's a monolithic label that applies in terms of the conception that is in the minds of the ordinary people, which has been built up in negative stereotyping, such as no rights for women, chopping of hands, four wives, stoning to death. This is what's been fed into the minds of the ordinary public. And people like Trevor Phillips respond in such a manner, saying, well, even the concept itself, one is not prepared to discuss. And say, well, if you don't accept it, you leave. Where would these British citizens born in this country go to? Would they be dumped into the English Channel? If only they were to realize that Muslims in this country, the community organizations, do practice Sharia in their daily lives. From the time a child is born, after the seventh day, the head is shaved. Boys are circumcised. When marriages take place, they do take place in mosques, places which are registered for marriages and worship. When my father died, he was buried according to the Islamic Sharia in the coffinless burial, again in line with the teaching of Islam. Islamic financial products are introduced today. You should read the Financial Times. The Chancellor endorsing the FSA facilitating Islamic Sharia financial products. What is all this? Sharia stands for justice in the society. It upholds and protects the life, the property, the individual, the community. But there's a civil aspect of it and the penal code of it. As far as the penal code is concerned, it's of course practiced in Islamic states. But even the very discussion is simply not allowed or tolerated. And yet here we are in a democratic society. We have, the Jewish community have courts, Beth Din, rabbinical courts, where they're able to have their civil issues of marriages and divorces applied, and judgments are given in the rabbinical courts. What are these Muslims seeking in terms of when they talk about Sharia? So I think people need to have this reassurance, and these stereotypes must be challenged. That can be achieved by the Muslim community proactively reaching out and interacting more with the society around them. But for diversity to be meaningful, reality, we must all accept that people's religious needs and differences are as important, and sometimes more important, than their ethnic needs and differences. The way to develop our mutual understanding is through greater dialogue and issues that concern us greater, on cooperations on areas of mutual interest and greater commitment to our joint well-being. The issues as far as the community organizations are concerned, they can work in partnership with other faith organizations, the churches, synagogues, temples. Wonderful examples exist across the country where they do work for the common good. An example where the Muslim community worked hand in hand with the Board of Deputies of the British Jews when the issues of halal meat came along. Strong pressure was put on by the animal welfare group in seeking to ban kosher and halal meat. Again, a joint effort supported by Muslim organizations and Jewish organizations were able to communicate to the department and say, well, that's the need of the community. And here again, many such examples exist where there's a census 2001, where for the first time the faith identity came into being. Again, organizations played its role in supporting, in promoting, in getting the message across to the departments. These are all examples of how community organizations can work through. In conclusion, the Muslim community and its organizations need to be quite clear and aware that we are not and cannot be a ghetto community. It is not and cannot be a community that is content with agitating from the sidelines against perceived ills and injustices. Whether these injustices relate to issues of local concern, national concern, or of international concern. We have to speak against those issues of injustices, as we have been doing in terms of anti-terror legislation. The glorification clause that is now being debated in the parliament, a very clear and a powerful message has come from the community, with that we believe it is a community that will be targeted because it's not defined. There's no question of anybody supporting to glorify terror or to glorify violence. That certainly is opposed. We cannot accept this. But then the manner in which it's been defined in the act is not clear. What it will do is suppress very genuine concern against speaking against autocratic regimes or injustices, against occupation, against oppression that is taking place. And we have a right to express our view on that subject. All we expect all the time round is fairness and equality. Let there be no doubt in our minds that we have the obligation to participate. We have the obligation to contribute. We have the obligations of good, neighborliness, of being concerned for others, to share their joys and feel their pains, to provide support and help wherever we can. This is what our faith requires of us. This is our unilateral responsibility. Thank you.
Much indeed. I'd now like to ask Khalida Khan to make a presentation, and her sister Hamera Khan will also be taking questions at the end.
My name is Khalida Khan, and I'm the director of the Anisa Society, which is a Muslim women managed voluntary organization, which has been running since 1985. And today I'm going to be talking about the Muslim voluntary sector. The lack of a strong Muslim voluntary sector is a major factor behind the status of the Muslim community as an underclass. This is because the voluntary sector is critical in the renewal and revival of our communities, especially those that operate at the grassroots level, because people need help, support, and advocacy at a very local neighborhood level. Although the voluntary sector as a whole has been depleted in recent years, the Muslim voluntary sector lags far behind the others, far even behind what is called the BME sector, because it never really got off the ground in the first place. Why this happened can be partly attributed to the lack of vision and long-term planning in the community itself. However, external factors played a greater role in undermining any Muslim effort at developing infrastructures and support systems. The Race Relations Act 1976 constructed an understanding of society based on race, which did not deliver for the multi-ethnic, faith-oriented Muslim community. This rendered Muslims invisible and made it almost impossible for them to access any significant resources and funding to develop faith-sensitive services. This left them without recourse to even the most basic of services, both within and without the community. As a consequence, Muslim families came under intense stress and pressure and started imploding from within. It was only when it began to explode outwards that any notice was taken of their plight. So what is the importance of the voluntary sector? In 2002, a government review of the voluntary sector and service delivery found that there are over 500,000 voluntary and community groups in the UK. In 2001, its income from government was £3.5 billion, the total income being in the region of £15.6 billion. A paid workforce of 563,000 and at least 3 million volunteers. The review also found that the sector is heavily involved in the delivery of public services, with 61% involved in accommodation and housing, social care, health education and training. The review identified a number of distinctive features of the sector, including 1, the provision of different or specialized services, 2, the cost effectiveness of provision, 3, flexibility and innovation, 4, advocacy, and 5 citizen participation. It also found that the voluntary sector may even have an advantage over other sectors and is able to deliver services more effectively to certain groups as it can operate in environments with which the state and its agents have found difficult or impossible. The voluntary sector acts as a conduit between so-called hard-to-reach communities and mainstream provision. It can promote joint working and dialogue and promote community cohesion. It can influence the way services are planned and designed at the local level and identify barriers and discrimination. At a national level, it can influence the way legislation and policies are shaped by the government. Because its views will have been formed from direct experience on the ground, its perspective is likely to be more relevant and effective. Amongst the specialized services that the Muslim voluntary sector can offer is to develop innovative faith-based approaches for the meeting of needs, which the mainstream is simply not able to do. For example, Islamic counseling, sexual health education, or the development of housing which takes on board Islamic concepts of building, such as promoting eco-friendly design and materials and private family spaces. These may even be ideas and thinking that may be of benefit to the wider society. The review identified that various states of severe welfare problems might lead some citizens incapable of benefiting from traditional supply mechanisms. And these states of disadvantage are financial. These are individuals who lack market power. Personal, these are potential users who cannot articulate a coherent preference. Or societal, which is individuals or groups who are stigmatized. Or community, this is people who live in a community where the usual civil structures have broken down. It concludes that the most excluded groups suffer from a combination of these states of disadvantage. And I would suggest that all of these states of disadvantage apply to the Muslim community. Hence the importance and necessity of a vibrant, dynamic, and well-resourced Muslim voluntary sector. So how do Muslims organize? The priorities of the early Muslims were in ensuring that the most essential religious and spiritual needs were met, requiring the provision of mosques, halal food outlets, and Islamic education for children. There were also the dawah, or Islamic propagation organizations, which were the most organized and resourced, often by foreign benefactors. Most of these efforts were self-financed by a mainly impoverished community. There was, and is, little in the way of a voluntary sector as we understand it. When I was working in housing, because I worked in local government for 12 years, my Muslim clients inevitably had the worst problems, and I had nowhere to refer them within the community for help and support. Not much has changed. To this day, we get calls from frantic workers seeking non-existent Muslim voluntary organizations to refer their clients to. In the main, the local authorities had little to do with the Muslims other than for planning permission for mosques and burial sites. When mosques became larger and the potential for great numbers of votes became apparent, the political parties courted these male-led organizations, often ignoring the women and young people. 21 years ago, when we set up Anissa Society, the number of Muslim-specific organizations catering for the social welfare needs of the community could be counted on one hand. We had to fight tooth and nail to be able to organize as a Muslim-specific group rather than as an ethnic group. It took years of hard work, lobbying, campaigning, and sacrifice to make some headway in obtaining public funding for faith-based projects. Most Muslim groups, like ours, are operating on a shoestring and lack both the capacity and stability to compete effectively in accessing the very competitive funding streams. We do not tend to have premises, which mean that we are in need of core funding for rent and running costs. And as you will know, core funding is virtually impossible to obtain. And Nisa, for example, is still operating on a crisis basis, not knowing from quarter to quarter whether we will be able to survive. Since 9/11, especially since 7/7, a younger generation has become socially active, with women leading the way in setting up health and social care projects. However, they have caught the boat too late, and local authorities no longer tend to have the premises and funds to provide for new voluntary groups. Capacity building, which is all the rage at the moment, is useless when you're struggling to run a small outfit from your sitting room. In response to recent events, the main thrust of Muslim activity has been at a national and international level. There are a disproportionate number of groups involved in political activity and campaigning, as opposed to working on health, social care, and economic issues. Government pressure and favor has led to the development of a representative body without the requisite constituency behind it. How can this representative body be tuned into the needs of the community when there is little in the way of local structures, infrastructures, that can feed into the central body. Infrastructures which should consist of a cross-section of interest groups and with representation from the most marginalized members of the community, such as women and young people. Who is going to implement what the representative body agrees with government on the ground? It is a case of the cart before the horse and very much a top-down approach rather than a bottom-up one. It is a case of too many chiefs and not enough workers. Therefore, where is the Muslim voluntary sector? It is in this context that disaster strikes on 9/11 and 7/7, and all attention is focused on the Muslim community. People are suddenly realizing that the community is in meltdown and they can't understand why. Some genuinely want to engage with the community to promote community cohesion, and others are being forced to involve Muslims. But where is the Muslim voluntary sector that is capable of being involved in engagement? It takes skills and years of experience to engage in such serious and sensitive matters. Muslims are being asked to participate in advisory forums, groups, forums, consultations, and working parties when most have never had the opportunity to participate at such levels. They lack experience and knowledge as to how to be effective and influence institutional and strategic change. Without funding, resources, and staff, not only are the few Muslim groups being stretched to the limit, the danger is that Muslim inexperience allows the government and other agencies to make superficial changes in their policies and services. In some ways, I wonder whether it is better not to be involved, because by being present at meetings, we are ratifying what is being agreed, whether we understand it or not. Many agencies simply want to tick the box and say they have consulted the community. To be effective, one has to have had experience of taking part in intra-community activities, inter-community networks, and in local consultative and networking bodies. You have to develop areas of expertise, such as the primary care trust, the police, or the Learning Skills Council. This is where you learn how the system works and hone your skills and learn how you can best influence them. This simply has not happened to any great extent in the Muslim community. And Muslims are suffering from several states of disadvantage. And suddenly, they're expected to participate in bodies and make meaningful inputs without any capacity building and resources. So I go on to what has been the government reaction following 9/11. The government is not engaging with Muslims as citizens and taxpayers who also contribute to this society. It is very much a case of you go back and sort yourselves out, without any reference to the role government, government policies, and Islamophobia has played in Muslim alienation and deprivation. It is in effect shirking its responsibility for 1.6 million of its citizens by trying to understand root causes instead of understanding root causes and developing robust policies and putting adequate resources behind them. It seems to me that the government approaches the Muslim community in a schizophrenic fashion. On one hand, it sees us as part of the BME community and treats faith identity and needs as part of the race agenda, which has spectacularly failed Muslims. On the other hand, when it comes to faith as a way of life, we are expected to function like the church, i.e. as if our institutions are built and developed on the lines of the church. It is all very much about high-profile meetings with Muslim leaders and politically motivated funding. A few big projects in areas of large Muslim populations, i.e. potential voters, and the general public gets the impression that Muslims are getting privileges and special treatment. After 9/11, the government could have, as a priority, brought in legislation to address discrimination on grounds of faith on a par with race legislation. This would have given us the legal tools required to make public services accountable on addressing anti-Muslim discrimination and social exclusion and empowering local grassroots organizations. If it was serious, the government could have done this when it had a huge majority. Instead, it was more concerned about its legislation on fox hunting. Nothing could have made it clearer to Muslims how little the government was bothered about them when the welfare of foxes was of more concern to them. Following 9/11, it was all about harsh anti-terrorism legislation that would only create more fear and alienation in the Muslim community. If the government had tackled it more constructively, we may have already begun to make headway in addressing Muslim alienation and giving Muslims a stake in this society. And I would even go as far as saying that it may have averted 7/7. So what is the way forward? And I've got some concerns and questions. The new proposed Commission for Equality and Human Rights, which is part of the Equalities Bill currently going through Parliament, will make religious discrimination unlawful in the provision of goods and services. Although we have supported this bill, we are extremely cautious because there is no track record in dealing with religious discrimination, and no effort has been made to understand the faith perspective. there are huge concerns when the government itself subsumes faith under the BME agenda. It is assumed that BME sector support will help the faith sector, and this doesn't necessarily follow. Due to the lack of experience and capacity in the Muslim sector, the well-established race bodies and BME organizations have moved into the faith and Muslim agenda. Over the last few decades, the BME sector has demonstrated its inability to understand and take on the issues that affect Muslims. Once again, there is the danger that Muslims will be led by others rather than develop its own expertise and capacity to speak for itself and address its own issues. There needs to be a new debate on the way we want diversity and equality issues to be taken forward into the new millennium. We are in a post-anti-racism era. We need to chart a new way forward and use new language and terminologies that are not full of baggage from the past. There is also the serious problem of government and other policymakers operating within a crisis management philosophy instead of a more proactive, strategic, and preventative approach. It is frustrating to be inflicted with sensationalist policies that lack both imagination and judgment. It is maddening to be expected to jump to attention every time the government wants us to deal with basically their agenda, such as its anti-terror policies and forced marriage, without addressing the wider issues affecting the community. There is a huge concern about the government socially engineering the Muslim community. Certain groups have been favored and taken forward. It seems that the government is trying to mold the community in the image it wants. In the community, the perception is that they simply want individuals and groups that toe the line and rubber stamp government diktats. It also smacks of the age-old strategy of divide and rule. This happened after the riots in the early 80s, when black groups began to fight amongst themselves over limited resources rather than their mutual injustices. While all these shenanigans go on, and despite all the rhetoric and volumes of reports on Muslims, Muslim advisors, and working parties, the majority of Muslim voluntary groups, especially those managed by women and young people, continue to be handicapped due to lack of funds and resources in providing for their deprived communities. Finally, I do not believe that much will change until we have a dynamic and well-resourced Muslim voluntary sector, which is confident, knowledgeable, clued up about the system, and able to challenge and participate constructively and positively. The more diverse it is, the better, because diversity is exciting and stimulating. But it should also be able to work things through and develop its own common agenda. If we want to prevent the Muslim community from sliding further into the abyss, it is a Muslim voluntary sector that has to lead on the work that is required and to be an equal partner with the government and other agencies. But I'm not very hopeful, because you only have to look at our case in point of our organization. We may have to close the society at the end of the month because we simply cannot access core funding that we need to pay for premises, staff, and work and running costs. Working in crisis mode for 21 years is impossible to maintain forever. And if this is our plight, then what does this say about the plight of the rest of the Muslim voluntary sector? Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. And now I'd like to ask Sarah Sharif from the Muslim Women's Helpline.
Right. The Muslim Women's Helpline is a voluntary charitable organisation which was set up in 1989 to provide a listening and emotional support service for Muslim women. I don't want to say too much about the helpline because it's sort of like that advert for the paint that you put on wood. It says what it says on the tin. It's Muslim Women's Helpline. The only thing I want to say is that we're there to emotionally support women. And also importantly, we set up because there was a great need that we identified to validate for Muslim women the religious sentiments that they had and which they drew upon in confronting the problems that they were facing in their lives. There is a tendency for us and for others to view us in isolation, but Muslim communities do not exist in isolation. They exist like other voluntary organizations, sharing the problems that other voluntary organizations face. And particularly faith organizations, you can have a Christian faith organization or a Jewish faith organization, and many of the problems will be the same. There are huge problems around organizing in the voluntary sector, especially at the moment when things change so quickly and so rapidly. And our problems are the same as those other organisations, but there are some special features which will run through my presentation to do with us being a Muslim organisation and a Muslim faith organisation at that. You've heard of Toys R Us. Well, stress is us at the moment, so if my presentation is a little bit negative and actually is you know, a grassroots on practical demonstration of what much of what Khalida has been speaking about. So I apologise for negativity, but I mean that's our experience, and I'm sort of at point number 11, and a lot of my trustees are as well, and so is our organisation. So that's where I'm coming from. My talk will cover issues of funding, issues of the operating environment, and issues around people, because obviously a voluntary organisation is people. The most important challenge a voluntary organisation faces, obviously, is sustaining itself in... What is this? Has been put in the wrong order. Okay. The most important aspect is funding. We've been going since 1989, and basically it's an ever-changing funding environment. In our own brief period of history, we've seen grant funding phased out to be replaced by service contracts, and this superseded by public sector procurement conditions, which are often so rigid and bureaucratic that, you know, we just feel this is not for us. There's no point us even attempting to apply. There's the confusing separation between national funding and local authority funding. And so a little organisation like ours, which is based in one locality, but actually provides a national service because it is so specialised, with Muslim women accessing from different parts of the country, from Scotland, from Ireland, from the northeast, northwest, we just fall between all those stools. National funding bodies say, you're local. Local people say, no, you've got too many national calls. So it's a complete mess as far as we are concerned. Our development in the early years was stunted by a lack of recognition for faith-based multi-ethnic, multi-racial efforts. Many times when we went to funding bodies, we were told in the early days, you are a Muslim organisation. We don't recognise that. You come to us as an Asian organisation, an Asian women's organisation, maybe we can look at being sympathetic towards the funding application. But we had women involved with us and accessing our services who were Indian, Pakistani, Arab, English, West Indian, all the different nationalities, because the Muslim community is extremely diverse, very multiracial. Of course, now there has been recognition by the government and through it, its various quangos of the faith aspect of the need to fund. But where grant funding becomes available for organisations like ours, whether it's through the Home Office or Department of Health, most ordinary members of the board, and including myself, and have been involved for about 15 years, and I still don't understand a lot of the jargon, the way in which you've got to present your information. And so we often have we're put in a position where the only way we can apply is by retaining somebody who's an expert. And to just show you that it's not just us, the NCVO has got a big fat directory of consultants that you can employ for capacity building, fundraising, for anything that you want. And obviously they don't come cheap. So it's hardly worth it for us. Where funding becomes possible, often, as Khalida mentioned, there is no money for core funding. And so we often find ourselves being encouraged to apply for money to meet funders' needs rather than funding to meet our clients' needs. And you know, our service is there to provide a service to our clients. And so, for example, in 2000, we were offered the opportunity for £5,000 to do a piece of social research. So, you know, our coordinator, who's very busy in the office, was sent off to the Midlands to do this little piece of social research, and it got all of us involved in it. And I remember for a week, I think I was working on it full-time, just preparing this report, which wasn't implemented. This local authority was going to implement some of the findings, but nothing came of that, and we thought, never again. We'd rather forego funding than be put through all of that. There's been one advantage to this situation of not being able to access funds, and that is that we've relied on the community. And the community has come true for us, especially our clients, you know, £5 standing orders every month, socially aware, active young professional Muslims who are aware of social issues, they help us, and of course fundraising, producing reports from time to time, organising a conference here and there, money has come in that way. But I can only say that we have survived, we haven't thrived. We have never had the luxury, for example, of a paid managerial person. All of the work of the helpline it's focused on us as trustees. So if all of us trustees are slightly fed up and slightly tired and slightly exasperated, it's just because we've had such a whole load to deal with. And I'll explain some of that load later on. The other aspect is that for our staff, the people who actually deliver our service, which comprised, until 2004, comprised one coordinator and three volunteers who came one day a week. Up till now, we're still delivering our service, from three desks with three telephones and answer machines bought from Argos. The staff are not very pleased because, some of them now have got opportunities to work in PCTs, etc., and they see everything more professional. And from our service point of view, it's not professional when we know we're losing maybe a third of the calls from clients who want to get through. And, of course, you get a reputation of we can never get through to that service. But, we had to do a survey, a mystery shopping type thing, and it was simply because the phone was already engaged with staff and people couldn't get through. If you had a sophisticated call management system, you could hold callers, you could transfer them to the desk that's free so that one or two people didn't have to keep jumping between desks as we do at the moment. The next aspect I wanted to speak about is the operating environment. The increasing requirement put on voluntary organisations, and we're included in that, to meet the highest professional standards in service delivery, has really been a big headache for us, especially bearing in mind the way we operate. This has arisen in a context of government saying that they want voluntary organisations to take greater responsibility for delivering welfare services. Is this a genuine acknowledgement that people's mobilisations really meet the needs of the community, or a way of getting out of state financial responsibility for delivering core welfare services? It's up to you, but many people feel that the government is spending too much money in various foreign adventures, etc., and maybe that's why they're interested in the voluntary sector, to take some of the strain. So instead, we're a charity, we expected to comply with charity law requirements, but now increasingly we also have to comply with issues around supervision, employment, insurance, client information, data protection, anti-terrorism legislation, a huge amount of stuff that's been put on us that we have to take responsibility for. Yet until 2003, as I mentioned, the cost of providing our service, it was literally the coordinator, the little premises, the telephone bills. So we worked out that it was costing us, the service, the community as a whole was benefiting from our service because our clients were costing £5, £6 tops per head. Mainstream organisations, mainstream well-funded voluntary organisation and the statutory sector, two or three times that amount. So where is the thing? Yet the responsibility for compliance with all these things is on our voluntary managers' sole shoulders. I don't want to knock standards. We've always aspired, right from the start, to be as professional as possible. We went to voluntary management school. We may be volunteers, but we're not amateur. Try and be as professional as possible. But we just simply don't have the dedicated staff to ensure compliance about all these areas. Other organisations, they've got a door for each manager: fundraising, legal, human resources, compliance, policy, development. We've got one or two people just trying to do everything, and it's just very exasperating, very tiring, and after a while you just want to give up. We've been working towards the telephone helpline. We're members of the Telephone Helplines Association. We've been working towards their quality standards, which is a prerequisite for us participating in the Mental Health Helpline Partnership, which is a government initiative, the NHS initiative, to devolve mental health services a little bit more to voluntary organisations. Maybe, again, cost-cutting, or, that voluntary organisations can meet people's mental health needs better than statutory services, whatever. We need to get this quality standard in order to be part of the Mental Health Helplines partnership, and hopefully that will bring some funding in at a future date. But it's taken us a year. We got to a point where, yes, you've got your three or four points off getting the quality standard, and then because such a long time has lapsed between when the first review of our work and our policies, etc., was done, now we're being asked to go back and review everything again and before we can present it. And this is just really exasperating, and particularly because one of our trustees actually works for the NHS, in a full-time job, and she was saying that the NHS policy review is 2 years out of date. But we're struggling to sort of meet the new deadline, which is the 31st of March, to have all our policies up to date, reviewed, and full compliance on a range of issues, including data protection, confidentiality, complaints procedure, all of these things. One of the biggest disincentives at the moment, we're having a huge problem about recruiting trustees, especially trustees who've got specialisms around policy development, compliance. One of the issues is that, you know, we take out two insurances for our service. One of them is professional indemnity insurance for trustees. Trustees just hear about this and think, whoa, not me, yeah? Rather not. So, this is a huge problem. And when you're a volunteer, you volunteer, you know, because you feel you want to contribute something, you want to have some sort of feedback. You don't want to get bogged down in bureaucracy, but, you know, that's unfortunately is what's been happening. The third aspect is people. Obviously, the people who are involved in our organisation are our treasure. We've never, ever had the luxury of having a single paid managerial person. So a lot of the pressure of managing the helpline has been on the management committee, on the volunteer board of trustees. You know, we're all people who've got full-time jobs, family commitments as aunts, as wives, as mothers, grandmothers. And we've got this helpline thing as well. Right from the start, we only ever had one part-time coordinator, three volunteer staff. And so the actual running of the helpline, managing meetings, publicising, fundraising, dealing with press, attending meetings, organising conferences, it's all been on the volunteer shoulders. And obviously, with the best will in the world, not everybody can commit and take hold their portfolio, so it then falls on two or three people's shoulders to, you know, really run the service. And obviously, it's extremely draining, and that's why many of us are sort of burnout point. On the other hand, the service delivery staff, we're saying to them, yeah, this is how you run the service. Here are your three Argos Sport telephones and answer machines, but we want you to be as professional as possible. We want you to comply with this and this and this. We want you to maintain your logs. We want you to do this. We want you to do that. And, you know, they feel very exasperated. And especially recently, when more awareness has arisen about faith issues, and some PCTs and some of the mainstream voluntary organisations, statutory bodies, oh, we need to have some Muslim workers who understand Muslim needs. They're sort of luring our experienced staff, now qualified staff, paid work, and you'll have all the wherewithal to actually deliver a service. So we're in this very sort of difficult situation of potentially losing our staff and at the same time, trustee burnout. So in 2003, I mean, literally we were on the crux of, you know, should we just chuck it all in now or shall we do something about it? And our solution was to throw all the money we'd scrimped and saved over the years, throw the money at the problem, retain our volunteer staff as sessional workers, get one of our trustees to stand down from the trustee board and take up a post as a consultant for service quality. And that's how we're managing it. It's working to the extent that we're not meeting every month as we used to as a management team. It's much looser. We feel a little bit less pressurized. The staff obviously are happier. They're getting some income from the work that they've been doing. But, you know, our money is running out so fast that we may be in a position where, there's a possibility with this mental health helpline partnership that we'll have the funds for putting in a call management system, etc., but we won't have the money to run it. So that will be interesting. The next 3 months, we'll know where we are. So a huge workload, and it's not surprising not many people want to sort of come and accept the role of trustee of the helpline. That brings me to the special aspect of being a Muslim women's organisation. I mean, it's a sort of run through what I've said already, but when we began our service, we very naively thought that the Muslim community as a whole, and it's male leadership, and not just because male, but because, you know, the purse strings are with the male leadership over the community, we thought that they would really appreciate the service to the extent that they would give it their wholehearted support. Unfortunately, we learned, you know, we were very optimistic. We heard of Chinese whispers that, you know, this is a Muslim feminist organization, they're dividing families, they will take husbands and wives, you know, split husbands and wives, take girls away from home, etc., etc. So this was in the first 5, 6, 7 years. So not a lot of support, contrary to what we had expected. On the other hand, as the community has grown in awareness, there has been acceptance. And the best way that you can see this acceptance is that Muslim organizations, mosques, you know, refer the women to us. And you have this sort of feeling that problem woman, get away, tell her to ring the helpline, or the other women's organizations, get off us, our case. But unfortunately, with that acknowledgement, with that acceptance, that the funds still haven't come. There isn't that willingness that there is to support a Muslim school or a mosque or, quite rightly, disasters. There isn't that same support for our sort of organisation, for women's organisations, and I would say also for youth organisations, as Khalida mentioned. You know, social problems just don't, you know, are not, there isn't the awareness yet in the Muslim community that these really need investment. So we've had that. On the other hand, the double whammy is the secular, liberal establishment, the welfare organisations, they marginalise us because their assumption is that, you know, Islam is the source of the Muslim women's problems. Muslim woman means oppressed because of Islam, and you know, Muslim women need to be liberated from their Islam. And if these women want to work within an Islamic framework, then they just have to be male-controlled, mosque-controlled. So we, you know, we just don't want to recognise and you know, acknowledge them. There's that sort of attitude, but at the same time, the statutory organisations, the mainstream voluntary organisations, who are very well funded, they quite happily get Muslim women clients who contact them who want support to, you know, ring voluntary services like the helpline. And you know, the best and most annoying one was, you know, GPs, NHS GPs, getting women with clinical depression, not just mental health issues, but clinical depression, to ring the helpline. And they surely are funded. But of course, there's the discrimination aspect, that whereas white people are more likely to get the talking therapies, BME communities, Muslim people are more likely to be medicators. And so on the one hand, whilst we would like to support these Muslim women who come to us, we're a little bit, you know, well, you acknowledge our existence, you acknowledge the fact that we are there, we probably can provide a service to these women, but where's the funds? You're the ones who are getting the funds to provide these services. You know, you've really got to sort of look at this. And hopefully the mental health helpline partnership that we're involved in will start flagging up these sorts of issues, we hope. I mean, that's why we're involved with them. But, I mean, this is a big problem for us, marginalisation by both the Muslim community and by the state liberal welfare establishment. So our solution, and maybe this will work, maybe it won't, has been to look for partners, whether Muslim or not. And we actually put this advert in a non-Muslim marriage support network bulletin. And we got responses from a couple of Christian organisations around relationship education. And we've also been part of the Mental Health Helpline Partnership and, you know, a very informal mobilisation of Muslim men who are active in the community. So all three of them, we're sort of working with them. We don't know what the outcome will be. Will our problems be solved? But, you know, there is a huge need to invest properly in the Muslim community, in Muslim women's mobilisations, because without that, as Khalida, you know, has already said, there's, you know, the development of the community and its ability to engage at national level will be affected. But, you know, we don't know what the outcome can be. As I mentioned, the Mental Health Helpline Partnership that we've been involved with, you know, they're helping us capacity build our technology, but without the money to actually, you know, run our service, the core service, we may have the technology but not the money to actually run the service. In the meantime, we're all at burnout point, and, you know, many of us are sort of always just waiting to sort of throw in the towel because, you know, we've really sort of come to this point. Whether, you know, our stress is going to continue, we wait to see, but we hope not. I mean, we hope some of these partnerships will bear fruit. But interestingly, the organisations, the Christian organisations and the local organisation, they're in exactly the same position as we are. You know, there's a lot of stress around being a voluntary, faith-based organisation.
Thank you very much. And our final speaker will be Fadi Itani from Islamic Relief.
Thank you, Chair. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters in humanity, it gives me a great pleasure to come back here after nearly 7-8 years. And why? Because actually we held our first national volunteers seminar for Islamic Relief in this hall, basically. And then to say thank you to them, we took them to the Thames, and we had a packed lunch for them, and we had basically a lunch on a boat. So we only bought for the top of the boat in order to be able to say thank you to our volunteers. So it's really a pleasure to come back here to the LSE. My name is Fadi Itani. I'm actually the head of the International Relations Unit of Islamic Relief, where I've been in this position now for 5 months. Before that, I was working on more regional, national project, which is called the Muslim Welfare House, based in the very famous Finsbury Park. And before that, I was working for Islamic Relief for another 11 years. So I have basically a bit of a national fundraising and then local solving, problem solving, and then now I'm trying to see how I can interact with the international, including the UN and the EU and so on. So the dilemma is basically getting bigger, not smaller for me. And my presentation is going to be about mainly about my experience between 2000 and 2005. I finished at Muslim Welfare House just the end of July, so after all the bombing took place, unfortunately. I thought that it was good that none of the bombers were from Finsbury Park. So that's mean my job is done, so I should leave and try to do something else. So the experience which basically I have is basically really is going to be a first-hand information, I have to tell you. And I may have to disagree with my colleagues about there is no Muslim voluntary sector, because I actually go further than the title voluntary sector, that it is organizations who just doing certain or the registered charities and so on. I go further than that. I believe every mosque in this country is basically a part of the Muslim voluntary sector. And you will basically see later why and what I'm talking about this. But just some general introduction, that Islam basically gives a serious importance to charity and giving. And as we probably, some of us, maybe most of us, zakat is one of the main pillars of Islam, which basically, unlike maybe other faith or religions, where charity and giving is basically something that they encourage, while in Islam is actually a must and a duty. Muslim organizations, like any other voluntary organizations, they really reach people where government and other agencies, as we heard from Sarah and from Khalida, they basically reach. And in a lot of cases, and this is where the mosque model will be used, that they actually are in constant touch with the community. And to be honest with you, I remember that when I was at the Muslim Welfare House, I used to see people 4 times a day, because the 5th time I used to be at home, a long way, for the morning prayers, that people, they come on a regular basis to these places. So whatever you have for them, message, information, anything you want to tell them, you basically have them there 5 times a day, every day, throughout the year. So basically, I remember when we want to launch any programs, either training program, unemployment advice program, counseling program, and so on, we did not have to advertise it. All what we have to do is just announce it on Friday, where we had nearly 2,000 people there, and then you basically have a waiting list after that for people waiting for the service. Something which I was hoping, and I was hoping to get in touch with Abdurrahman, who's here before this presentation, because it was seriously difficult to get any facts and figures about the Muslim voluntary sector. Until basically I thought, let's do some research and do some calculation according to my national and local experience with some of them. And I start coming up with some interesting figures, which I hope that we can probably benefit from them. We have nearly 624 charities. We have 12 international NGOs, who in a sense they're effective and they exist. And we have 110 schools, and we have over 200 and so for different sports and activities, and we have 1,800 mosques. And most of those places and mosques and so on and organizations, they've been done or built by self-financing of the Muslim community. And the figures we have is very interesting. just, and all this, to be honest with you, they actually very conservative estimates. In the way we calculated, we went for an average cost of places around the country and the number of people using them and so on. So we have nearly over £450 million of assets, buildings and so on, and £90 million of running cost. And this is a pure, the minimum that those places are running on. And nearly £40 million of contributions of the Muslim community towards the international development through their NGOs. And this is, of course, not to mention the contributions that individuals, they do send directly. And in a recent report I was reading, the World Bank, the communities, the migrant communities, they transfer and send around £50 billion to their own countries and basically families, friends, and relatives, and so on. £50 billion, which the report is actually encouraging the international development agencies and ministries and the treasuries to basically see how this package or aid packages can benefit from this and take it into account. There is a lot of money being sent directly to help and support those communities in different parts of the world. We basically go into some internal audit, in a sense, and we basically, there's nothing special. Khalida mentioned the youth involvement in the Muslim voluntary sector, mosques, charities, and so on, is quite low-key, seriously low. Of course, the absence of women's role is another one. There is extremely poor fundraising skills. There is a need for professional and strategic vision. They mainly run by small number of volunteers, as we just heard from Sarah. There is hardly any full-time staff, always inward-looking, and I mean they just want to solve the problems of the community, which I don't blame them, but this, to be honest with you, does not take you any further. In a sense, it just make you short-sighted. And the infrastructure which we talked about is nearly £450 million, is seriously worn out because of the number of people they use, those centers and mosques and organizations. I remember we used to have at least around 5,000 people using our center a week. And if they just walk in and walk out, you just imagine what you need to do after that. So if they do this every week, so basically the infrastructure needs a lot of investment. There is a need to address pressing issues and priorities. What we heard from Sarah, what we heard from Khalida, is not a surprise, actually. When we have these resources in the community that being built by the community and not utilized, people like Sarah and Khalida, they have to go wherever to try to exist and struggle for their survival, which is seriously is a sad thing. I remember in a very short time we had at Infinity Park Muslim Welfare House, we, beside our own activities and our own programs, we accommodated 6 organizations' activities a week. And I remember one of them, or two actually, they were quite serious that when the local council cut their funding, they lost their offices, they lost their paid staff, but they ended with their beneficiaries or their community to serve. And basically didn't have any place to go. So I said, you come here, use the center, but tell me when you want so I can book it, so it's always available for you. And then the organization still exists, but without funding, but they still can deliver and help the community. Of course, the absence of waqf, which we call it trust or endowment, is something quite serious and is basically a strategic solution for the Muslim community and other communities for the long-term development of those communities. External factors, Muslim NGOs or Muslim charities, like many faith-based organizations, they face basically the same or the difficulties, especially in terms of funding. The Muslim organizations recently, they've been a victim, or I call them the innocent victims of the post-September 11th and the 7/7 and so on, where basically even those who registered those who organize, those who are transparent, those who are accountable, those who are doing a lot of good work, they no longer can really operate or transfer money or even receive money. As soon as you transfer, and I remember we had a case, an organization transferring $250 of its fees membership to an umbrella organization in Egypt. The $250, they stayed 3 months somewhere, not to offend anybody, because it was sent from a Muslim organization. Clearly, it was a Muslim organization. So just imagine, if you really want to develop this sector and you want to help it, what kind of difficulties that they're facing because of the anti-war, anti-terrorism issues. Of course, there is misunderstanding and prejudice against religion generally. And I remember I actually was, in a sense, the first chairman of the Islington Faith Forum for a year. And I remember that I used to go and have to fight for the Muslim community issues, because this is what I got used to and I have to do it every time. But then I was shocked seriously to see that I also have to fight for anything to do with faith, which basically a very small secular, individuals controlling funding and policies and so on, they really make the life seriously difficult for organizations who has anything to do with faith. Even when we are doing some good work, which is something to do with social actions and neighborhood programs and regeneration issue and so on. Issue of discrimination is nothing new to us and to you. Struggle with the local authorities to recognize the needs of the Muslim organizations and local communities. I remember we have to fight on, as a Muslim organization, that we have to fight on the issue of the BME. And then there is also other organizations which basically working with disabled people. And then you have also, basically we all has to fight for the same piece of cake. Which it was really seriously a problem, and also that they could not recognize that those organizations, as Khaled rightly said, there is a vote there. And to be honest with you, when we start using this, we start getting attention of the local councillors. If I have 3,000-4,000 votes or more, and I remember like in Islington we had 8% of the local population, they are Muslims, 8%. And they basically, what kind of, I said to, and this openly I said to the councillor, what kind of attention you're giving to those 8% of your local resident? I mean, and I will leave the answer with you basically. There is absence of Muslim representatives on boards and consultative committees. Khalid really mentioned some of this. We don't need just representative there, but also we need representative in a sense. I'm not talking about national, this is local. Because if we really develop locally, as she rightly said, we will be able to really take part on a national basis. And also the community will start to have a say on what kind of education we want, what kind of policing we want, what kind of PCTs we want, what, you know, this different things. Of course, we have a poor and negative media coverage. And there is a serious, really, shortcomings in the issue of partnership. I'm really pleased to hear Sarah what she said, that we really maybe we go for partnership with other organizations. I think this is seriously the way forward for the either organizations from the faith-based or for the Muslim organization to go for really partnership among themselves, and for organization to exist to also fight. I mean, the fight is not just external. The fight is internal. If I cannot really base a seriously needed project by the women, the young people, by our community in a building which being paid by the Muslim community, I think we have really serious problem here. And we have a few examples around the country, and I have to say they are not many, unfortunately. I think in London we have a few. We have like the London Muslim Center. We have the Muslim Cultural Heritage Center in West Kensington. We have in Balham and Tooting also a mosque where basically they've been utilized for not just one thing. And I will tell you later what I mean by this one thing. The environment, the Muslim organization, they're working around, from what I've seen on the ground, is really seriously complicated environment, from the police to the local council to the local service providers, trustees and committees, funders, donors, young people, women, and so on. So they really, unless they position themselves strategically in a professional way, I don't think they will be able to serve not just their community. I don't think they will be able to even serve themselves. It's just a nice example of what you can do with a mosque, which is the slogan there is pray and go. It's not pay and go, it's pray and go. And this is, by the way, copyright for me, so don't use it. So basically, just we have huge, beautiful places in the faith communities where they're not utilized. They are seriously underutilized. And you just give you an idea of. I got it. Yeah. It just gives you an idea of what you can do. This is some just of what you can do in. It's not just a mosque, in a synagogue, in a temple, in a church. It's just, we don't just want people there for Friday or for Sunday or for Saturday. Those places, they really cost money to run. Bills, waters, etc., etc., etc. They really need to be multi-purpose places to serve their communities. And I think this is the way forward for the people from the faith communities. I'm nearly there, so it's hopefully the last one. So I believe there is a few things would like. I personally think this is the way forward. We need really serious capacity building inside or for the Muslim community and other faith communities. There is a need for some capital investment, despite the fact we have nearly £500 million of assets available there. There is a serious need for better volunteers management. You can just imagine if you have 2,000 people in, say, Friday prayer or on Sunday prayers, or service, that among them there will be a lot of good professional people. And probably sometimes, and I used to say this at Muslim Conference, I believe and I'm sure that there are people in the mosque during the prayer that are more qualified than me as a director of the center. And those people, they really can make a change and make a difference. Of course, women and young people involvement will be the way forward for our organizations. Internal external partnership, I mean internal by Muslim organizations working together, like NISA, like the Muslim Women's Muslim Women Helpline and others, to really seriously fight and get their share in those spaces and those resources. It's not going to be easy, I have to say. Utilizing resources better, I mean mosques and centers and so on, and adopt a multi-use policy, I mean multi-use space policies for those places. And finally, of course, this is something which we've been fighting for, that we have a lot of contributions going from the Muslim community going away, and I know some people are critical of this, which is they have the right to do so, although we'd like to encourage more funds to go towards international development, but we believe also there is a need for contributions and investment for the Muslim community. And I have to say, we do have, and I finish with this, we do have in the Muslim voluntary sector, and I'm using this general term, I'm including the mosque, we do have the seed to succeed, because the places are there. The Muslim community, which we heard nearly how much we talked about, just running cost of £90 million. This is not coming from anywhere, to be honest with you. This is coming by the pound and the £5 of the individuals for the running cost of the mosque and places and so on. So we do have really the basics and the seeds to succeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, I think we've got a very rich picture of some of the challenges facing Muslim communities and difference of views about whether it's a voluntary Muslim voluntary sector or not. We've got about 10 minutes for questions, and I think we can also continue upstairs on the fifth floor, team copies. So can I take some questions from the floor? Yes, the gentleman at the back.
Thank you very much. I'd like to say that
the microphone is just coming.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to say I probably agree with the last speaker, Fadi Tani, regarding the fact that there is a huge voluntary sector presence within the UK Muslim community. It's about looking at a new model of how we transfer the old traditional setups of mosques and taking it forward to the next level of growth and development necessary to meet the Muslim challenges. And I know Muslim Women's Helpline, even when I was a student at King's College and LSE, I might add here, that we did some fundraising for Muslim Women's Helpline, and they're a great organization. It's about getting the traditional communities to recognize how valuable their services is and taking it on board. And people like the MCB, who already do a formidable job, it's about MCB doing its role of getting the Muslim community to recognize this as well. I feel that's been that's quite a key thing. So I agree with Fadi Sani's concept of a very large Muslim voluntary sector organization already in existence. It's about transferring to the next level. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes, gentlemen, over there.
I'd just like to say thank you to all the presenters. I belong to an Islamic organization, Islamic Circles. We've worked with the Muslim Women's Helpline and many other voluntary organizations. We did an event last year, building the social institutions within the Muslim community. Part of the problem I see within the Muslim community is we don't take social problems seriously in the Muslim community. We've got a lot of armchair philosophers and critics, and at the same time, a lot of our communities who are very rich, I'm sorry, I'll say this, we're very rich, but we don't want to invest locally. I feel we're too politically international with international issues when it comes to home issues like domestic violence, matrimony problems, etc., etc., we're not there. But we'll have demonstrations every week for international issues. Sorry to bring this up, but this is how I feel, and it's very frustrating. But all the points there were absolutely spot on. Jazakallah.
Okay, I think one of our panel members would like to respond to that comment. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm just here because Khalid is not feeling very well, so I'm answering the questions for her, or just whatever. I think the thing is that it's obvious by the panel is of an obvious gender divide in perspective. And I think how you understand the community is through the prism in which you're looking at the problem. And I think that, with all due respect to our male speakers here, it's a very structural, top-down, looking at it very paternalistic sort of way of what the community is. And I think the Muslim community has to wake up to the 21st century. We are not going to go back to anything we remember from the past. We have to be creative for something new. And I'm sorry, Fadi, I understand what you're saying and I agree with what you're saying, but the fact is the vast majority of mosques are just a sort of melting pot of social mess. There are people who are not being dealt with adequately. There may be a few, okay, so I don't want to be universal about it, but they are not dealing with it. Like Halida said, everybody wants to tell everybody else what to do, but nobody wants to go and get their hands dirty. And I think it's so clear that what we end up doing as Muslims immediately from the questions, we blame ourselves for everything. We are certainly responsible, but we are citizens in this country, and the government has a responsibility to provide for its citizens equally without discrimination. And unless our Muslim leadership recognize the root and the seed and the source of this discrimination and see us as being... We are from here. I'm here. I'm afraid I have personally no other terms of reference about them being from this country. I have no allegiance to any Muslim country. So, and this government is letting me down because it doesn't value me and my contribution. So until it sees me, people like me, from that point of view, we are not going to go forward. And the forward that we're going to is something different, and we need to. And women, I really hate it when people are paternalistic about women, but women have always been doing things. We continue to do things, whether people recognize it or not, it's their problem, I'm afraid.
Thank you. Did any of the panel members want to respond, or should I take another question? Okay, I'll take another question. Yes.
I'm Linda Lundqvist from Intrac. We work with civil society and capacity building. And I've noticed that now...
Can you speak louder into the microphone, please?
Recently, it's become quite a hot topic about faith-based organizations and Muslims especially, and people are waking up thinking, wow, we have to engage more. And all of a sudden you start casting around for potential partners for the Muslim voluntary sector. And from Khalida's presentation, it sounds like there's not a very solid tradition of these formal organizations with secretary, treasurer, chair, board of trustees. So my question is whether you have in mind any other kind of more organic, informal types of organization that typical to Muslim communities, perhaps.
Okay. Who would like to take that?
I don't think I agree that there isn't really a formal, even the example I gave, that mosques, I mean, each mosque has a committee, has a chair, it has a treasurer, and they all volunteers, basically. Probably the only guy who is paid there is an imam, and the poor guy, if he's not local, this is another problem for the local community. And also, there are quite few organizations exist, in a sense of, because most of them register charities, and as you know, if they are, they need, I mean, to be registered, you have to have certain structure and so on. But what we don't have, and this is something which probably need to be looked at, is we do not have an umbrella for voluntary sector organizations. Although we have the Muslim Council of Britain as an umbrella for a lot of organizations, political, religious, and so on, and etc. But we don't have really a specialized umbrella that probably you can interact with. But I think from even from people on the panel, basically you can really start a good, I mean, you can have a good start on how to go about really engaging with the Muslim organizations and so on. And just you need to be careful that there's been a lot of discussion about how to engage and who to talk to and who not to talk to and so on. I think to solve this political problem, we need really to understand why we need to engage with them. Is it for professional reasons? Is it for joint partnership programs like what Sarah mentioned? Or is it just to make sure that the political problem gets under control, which, you know, and this is especially we start seeing it after the 7/7. So I think there should be some good, valid, sincere reasons of why you want to engage with certain organizations. Thank you.
I think the key point that comes out is how come that the faith bodies that have been in existence for so long perhaps have not really worked their way up in establishing as a bona fide bodies like any other bodies in the country. It's only very recently. I mean, the faith identity itself really came in 2001 under the census when we were able to, you know, very openly declare ourselves as British Muslims or as a Hindu or as a Sikh as well. Prior to that, the faith identity was basically non-existent. As we had mentioned early on, the laws that were in place were based on ethnicity. And in fact, it was with contempt the faith communities were looked at. Now, the progress that has taken place over the last sort of 10 years is where there is some clear recognition given to the extent the local authorities for the first time now are able to provide funding to faith organizations. I've been involved with my local mosque, in Balham Mosque, since its inception in 1970-71. And I remember the local projects that we were dealing with, which were more to do with the helping the women, the old folks, providing youth activities, which are very normal. I mean, nothing to do with proselytizing or propagating faith. But when we went to the local council, simply, no, you are a faith body, it's to do with religion, and you know you cannot apply for it. But then after really understanding the real issues, that it is the community that we are serving on the ground. And one example that we gave was the service of providing circumcision in the mosque. Interestingly, 60% of those who came along were non-Muslims. And it is then when the council realized that, look, a mosque being a religious body can provide service to the larger community as well. And it's then that the understanding came in that, yes, we need to support. So I think it is that period of time that is taking place. And there are wonderful examples across the country. Mosque which Father gave early on, where this multilateral, multifaceted activities are taking place. And realizing that, look, a mosque is not just a place where you come for five times prayers and go away. Young people are now getting more and more involved. But of course, we need to encourage them. And the Muslim Council of Britain, we are making it clear. The issue of transparency, accountability to the community, the laws, the charitable laws that are in place now, The compliance has to come in as well. A trustee is not longer free to sort of say, I'm a board of member of the trustee without any obligation. There are clear obligations of the trustees as well. So these are matters which the committee is trying to engage. It's very difficult. We are well behind, no doubt about it. But I think we have to accept the reality that there's some progress taking place, and we can encourage that progress, develop it further, find out the weaknesses, and move along on the basis.
Okay, thank you. I'll have final comment from Sarah Sharif, and I think we'll have to close and continue our discussion upstairs. Thank you.
I just wanted to comment, because you mentioned about officer roles within committees. One of the strands, if things don't work out for us, there's a strand within my, board of trustees and also amongst the staff that, we try to do things in the British way, having all these roles and these responsibilities. But if we're not getting anything out of it, why not go back to the old original cottage industry helpline, where we just operate out of a house, quit out of the charity commission, quit out of the telephone helplines association, don't get involved in any of that, with whatever it is, £400-£500 a month, which comes in through standing orders. We can quite easily run our helpline service from two or three volunteers home, and just completely drop out, become one of these, instead of being a tight organization, become a loose tight organization, and just almost like a more organic existence, and maybe that might be a way we have to go. And for some of us, it's like the horizon, that the rainbow at the end of the thing. That if working in this way, we're just beating ourselves over the head for nothing really. We're not getting anything out of it. Then just not operate like this. Just go back to the original vision, where we were set up to provide a service to our clients, nothing more, nothing less. If the bureaucracy and everything else, which we we play along with because we think this is the way to operate, if it's not benefiting, and because of that we're not benefiting the clients, then we drop out. And that's the danger, that it's just us. Other organisations are thinking along the same way. So instead of being within the radar, we're going to sort of drop under the radar. And it's all right for organisations like us, which are quite harmless. We if we do something like that, we're just there to provide a service to women. But maybe other organisations are also thinking, we play by the rules, we do things in the proper way, and we don't really get anything out of it, so drop out.
Thank you. And one final remark from Homera, then we will close.
I think I just want to make a very quick comment about who the Muslim community actually is. And I think, in the sense, because the government wants to play safe, it wants to project, like Khalid said earlier, a certain kind of a Muslim who is looks a certain way. I don't want to say any stereotypes of what they look like, but they look a certain way and they behave a certain way. But the fact is, the vast majority of the Muslim population is not served by any kind of organization at all. And the sort of people who go to the mosque, they may go to the mosque, they sort of chip in like a hen, picking up a corn. They go in and they're out. But the vast majority of Muslims in this country, particularly young people and women, are not part of any kind of organization network. And no organization has any authority over us, right? And so therefore, which Muslim community are you talking about? You're talking about a very tiny percent of the population who control the mosques and the sort of organizations Farley talked about. They are tiny, and most of those, I'm sorry to say, are rooted in political ideologies from abroad. They have every right to do that, and I don't say that as a criticism. I'm saying that they come from a baggage from abroad. There's no space for organic growth for us, and I've seen all sorts of eclectic group of young Muslims who most probably a non-Muslim would say, oh, but they're not typical Muslim. But actually, whatever you may see on the outside of a Muslim, the vast majority, I would argue, more than 90% of them inside see themselves as a Muslim, regardless of what you see on the outside. So therefore, these people are not being catered for. And we need to look, really open our eyes and step back and open up who it is that we consider and who we let in, and not exclude people and have it far more sort of broad-based. That's what I think.
Right, thank you very much. Thank you for a very interesting and fascinating discussion. It's very rich in content, and I think there's a lot of food for thought. And I hope we can continue this dialogue upstairs over tea, coffee, and snacks. So please do join us on the fifth floor. Thank you.